Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for November's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Veterinary Specialist in Emergency and Critical Care, Chris Gommeren. Thank you, Chris. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this webinar. This is my very first webinar session ever, so I'm also intrigued to how this is going to evolve. And I actually agreed upon doing this a long time ago, knowing that we will be slowly leading up to the Emergency Critical Care Congress in Ghent in Belgium. And I'm trying to get you all convinced to attend this wonderful congress, which I'll be one of the local organizers for. So that was my commercial ad for the moment. There will be some repeating us shortly. Before we get started, I really strongly must insist that the work that I'm presenting is not just my own work, not at all. It is an introduction to what point of care ultrasound is these days in veterinary medicine, and it is a collaborative project with Søren Boysen and Serge Chaloup from the faculty in Calgary, and from Anne-Christine Mervet, the cardiologist, and myself at the University of Liège. We are all strong believers in the use of an ultrasound probe in an emergency and critical care setting. And so what I'm going to try to do over the next hour is to run by you some history on how it evolved, what we can do with it these days, and of course, trying to respect the fact that this is a webinar. So it will be a short overview. There will be much more information out there in literature than what I can present in an hour, which should at least get you all very intrigued on how you should use this probe in a safe and useful manner in practice. So if you, at the end of this session, think I want to learn more, take your agendas and reserve the 3rd of June in 2020, in which there will be a point of care ultrasound symposium supported by the European Veterinary Emergency Critical Care Society in Ghent in Belgium. We'll also have fantastic beers over there. Now that it's lunchtime, that is something you might be willing to consider. So, where did actually point of care ultrasound come from? It's safe to say it's not something we as veterinarians invented. There are a lot of medics out there, and someday someone got the wonderful idea to use its ultrasound probe to assess patients that were just traumatized. And so, hence the acronym FAST that you might have heard several times. So, it comes from focused assessment with sonography for trauma. And it was actually developed by medics who were non-radiologists to have a quick assessment whether there was any free fluid in the abdominal, pleural, or pericardial space. Since then, this has evolved tremendously in human medicine as well. And so it's now applied to discover pulmonary disease, cardiac disease, get an idea of volume status, evaluate bladder filling and GI motility, and to guide several procedures. I think it is also very important, just for your info, to get an idea of how big this is booming business in human medicine, that if you see a rep for an ultrasound company these days, they will have tablet format ultrasound devices. And in many ICU facilities in human medicine, you will actually see ultrasound machines next to the critical care bed patient against the wall. So they can always, at any moment, do point of care ultrasound, hence the name. So that is clearly what we're trending towards. I think when I talk to vets and nurses about doing point of care ultrasound, some get this horrific idea of naked pets on an unintended fashion because we've clipped them all over to be able to see. That clearly is not the case either. We will just part the fur and then apply some alcohol, or if you want, some hand sanitizer, just to make sure there's no air in between. And then we get decent enough images. Again, we're not looking for a perfect ultrasound. We're looking for a point of care ultrasound, which will be much more superficial and limited. And we will try to focus on some closed and binary questions. Every time when I speak with my students and we talk about emergency medicine, I think one of the main things you need to have when faced with an emergency is structure. And so, in order to avoid using your ultrasound machine, just like blood work is often used as the magic complementary examination, which will suddenly, by chance, give you the correct answer, you should think before you start doing point of care ultrasound, just like you should think before you request blood work, what you're actually looking for. What are the things you want to highlight? What are the things you want to rule in and rule out? And then focus on the question, because that will guide you. And so, despite the fact that In the meanwhile, there have been lots of scanning protocols out there when it comes to point-of-care ultrasound. The goal of today will not be to make a comparison in between all of those protocols out there and to give some quality impression I might have about those different protocols. It is about being logic and respecting what the logic behind each protocol is. And as long as you use whichever systematic approach and you break it down into these binary or closed questions, you should be able to get valuable information without getting overemphasis on things that are perhaps trivial or irrelevant to your case. So, as a reminder, point of care ultrasound, it is not a complete or comprehensive ultrasound. I have never tried to look at the pancreas. I have never tried to look at the adrenal glands. If for those who one day in a boring moment read my CV, I'm actually an internist by training who did a PhD on cardiology and who actually loves emergency critical care. So there's no ultrasound in that list. So I really limit myself to those closed questions in an ECC procedure, and as many of the papers in Human Medicine will state, the stethoscope might have been the breakthrough to allow you to hear what's happening inside. The ultrasound will allow you to see what's happening on the inside. But you should not overemphasize what you see if you did in a non-systematic approach. For us working at universities, I think one of the larger benefits, of course, of it is that it's so fresh and new and it's such undiscovered territory that it's immediately extremely exciting. The first part I would like to discuss with you is point of care ultrasound of the abdomen. And for all of you who are actually already working in practice and who have had contact with an ultrasound probe, this is probably what you're most familiar with. And so it's not going to be rocket science, it's mostly the technique that I just want to run through. So if you look at the initial FAST protocol for the traumatized patient, there's very little that has changed when it comes to point of care ultrasound of the abdomen. The main concern for which it was developed was, is there any free fluid in the abdomen of my patient? And so the technique was described in a right lateral position, and you place your probe at four different quadrants, being the diaphragmatic hepatic side, which is cranial underneath the subxiphoid process, the splenorenal side, the cystocolic side, and the hepatorenal side. And although you see those arrows and it could look like a sliding movement, I usually tend to tell everybody, lift your probe when you go from point one to two, from two to three, and from three to four. You put your probe at position number one. You will scan, you will fan and rock in both directions to see whether there's any sign of free fluid there in between the hepatic lobes. You will then lift your probe and go to number two. The reason for lifting your probe is exactly to remind yourself that you're not just going on a treasure hunt and by chance you could find something. You're doing a structured examination. You lift your probe from spot one to two to three to four. You look in all of those quadrants where there's any sign of free abdominal fluid. And if you do so and you have a Great Dane, accepting the fact that you might still miss an important region in the abdomen, feel free to add the fifth spot, which is the umbilical side, just to make sure that even in between the intestinal loops, there's not a little pocket of free fluid that you would want to aspirate. It would not be the very first patient with a septic peritonitis due to a perforating ulcer of the GI tract that you could miss. That GI ulcer is already the first hint that ever since we started doing this for the hemoabdomen cases after trauma, that point of care ultrasound of the abdomen has sufficiently evolved. So when you look at the diaphragmatic hepatic side, we also want you to evaluate whether the gallbladder is intact and present, whether there's any sign of a gallbladder obstruction, or whether there might be any sign of gallbladder wall edema, which I will come back to in a minute. You also want to assess whether the urinary bladder is actually present and is changing in size if you want to monitor this throughout the hospitalization of your patient. So there's additional benefits. But in the beginning, there was an abdominal fluid score for the hemoabdomen patient that was being calculated, being I see fluid A1 or I don't see fluid A0. And in those four quadrants, your hemoabdomen after trauma could have a score of 0 to 4. Now, I don't think it will be very surprising to understand that those who have blood in three or four quadrants are probably more severely affected than those who have one or two sites being affected. But it does have a clinical use in practice. In that paper, they also identified that those dogs who have a score of 3 or 4 and so have a massive abdominal bleeding, much more likely will already have a hematocrit or a packed cell volume underneath 20%. Hence, they are much more likely to require emergency transfusion. So if you see free fluid in a traumatized patient in 3 or 4 quadrants, and it is a hemoabdomen, you might start your initial resuscitation with isotonic crystalloids, but you probably should have a direct conversation with the owner that you're aiming for a transfusion if you want to stabilize this patient. If, however, you only have blood in 1 or 2 quadrants, most likely his hematocrit will still be above 30%, and probably just some crystalloids could do the trick in the beginning. And then, obviously, once more, you will track your patient and see how things evolve. If a patient stops bleeding in his abdomen, he will resorb those red blood cells, but the same paper also demonstrated that a patient with a hemoabdomen will not suddenly become negative within 4 hours if a trauma was the cause of the hemoabdomen. If you have never looked for free fluid in your life before, then probably the first region where we'll easily identify this free fluid will be at the systolic region, because your bladder is this hypoechoic fluid-filled structure with a hypoechoic convex outer wall, and you will see the free fluid on the other side of that wall as another amount of hypoechoic fluid. So this is probably the first site that you will identify this, and if you look at the picture on the bottom right, you suddenly identify what could be described as an ugly mess, and that is because you don't see a clear urinary bladder anymore, and this patient actually has got a urinary tract rupture. Even if you would be unsure, you should be able to identify the pocket of free fluid, which I will highlight here. And if you would puncture and aspirate via abdominoscentesis this little pocket of fluid, and you would measure creatinine and compare it to the bloods, you should be able to at least identify that this patient had a uroabdomen. So again, another way where you could use it. I'm gonna take the arrow off. Ever since then, Greg Lysander, who has published a ton of papers on point-of-care ultrasound and has been really helpful in the development of this technique, also published a paper in which they identified you could actually estimate bladder volume. And for those of you who have been working in a critical care setting, I think we've all placed a huge amount of urinary lines on patients in the perioperative period because we were very concerned about an acute renal insufficiency after the anesthetic event. And we all know that this can actually be associated with contamination of the bladder and a cystitis. So just tracking the size of your bladder using ultrasound could also inform you whether there is an acute anuria or oliguric event while avoiding this complication. So by all means, the next time you're doing a point-of-care ultrasound scan, try to just assess what the volume of your bladder would be and convince yourself that you can track the change in size throughout time quite easily. A final technique that we're actually describing in point-of-care ultrasound of the abdomen in more and more institutions is to train your staff to assess their kidneys and especially the pelvis of your kidneys in your cats who are being presented with azotemia in an emergency setting. Because one of the new diseases we're getting more and more at referral institutions are ureteral obstructions. And the approach to your patient presented with acute onset disease, severe azotemia, and what looks like to be acute renal disease or ureteral obstruction differs greatly. And the plan for those patients and the budget you should talk to with the owners varies greatly again. So if you learn and train yourself to just look at the kidney and identify the pelvic inlet and see whether there's any sign of dilation, that again will give you a lot of valuable information. You will probably not be proficient in finding the small ureterolet, which typically is 2, 3, or 4 millimeters in size. But if you look at the pictures on the right, which are all severe hydronephroses, you will be able to pick this up, and then you will change your approach. I had promised you I would come back to the gallbladder wall. And so if we look at the gallbladder wall, you can identify edema of its wall. And so the gallbladder depicted here has got a fine hyperechoic line surrounding the lumen, and then suddenly a larger thick hypoechoic zone which is all edema of the gallbladder wall because you see another hyperechoic line surrounding it. Whenever you see this, you should think this is a severe abnormality, and it has been at first described, again by Dr. Lisandro, in situations of anaphylaxis, but in all honesty, that is probably more a regional situation, because if you are in Belgium, and I suspect also in the UK, it is much more likely that your patient is actually suffering from right-sided congestive heart disease or pericardial tamponade, because this will very typically also create gallbladder wall edema. And so every time you see gallbladder wall edema, look through your diaphragm to the heart whether you see any sign of pericardial effusion, because you might easily miss the presence of muffled heart sound. Actually, stethoscopes will only help you to detect roughly 50 to 60% of pericardial effusions. Radiographs will miss a bunch of those as well. And so sometimes on clinical and on history, you're not that convinced something could be a pericardial effusion. But if you see this gallbladder wall edema, think you might be volume overloading your patient, or it could already have a right side cardiac disease to begin with. And obviously, if you have snakes in your garden and you had a snake bite, then definitely consider anaphylaxis or even sepsis as well. So in summary, when it comes to point of care ultrasound of the abdomen, the reason why you should be interested to do it is mostly because it is so not expensive and inexpensive. There's no radiation involved. It's purely non-invasive. And you can do this while your colleague is already placing it. The catheter is doing a bunch of other things, and you should be able to get your information within a couple of minutes. And as said before, you can also track whatever you saw easily. You will be very unlikely to go back and forth to the radiology room 10 times over the first 2 hours because you think there might be a subtle change in your patient. If you have your ultrasound machine next to your patient, you will not be annoyed by repeating the exam several times. So feel free to repeat your exams every time you think it is required. Second part I would like to run you through is the thoracic cavity. Now, me myself as well, when they told me you can do ultrasound of the thoracic cavity, the first thing you would say is that's going to be impossible. The one thing I've learned from the imaging department is that my ultrasound beams do not like air and bone. So if I'm going to evaluate the thoracic cavity, I'm bound to just be confronted with bones and air. But that's actually what makes it so easy. I'm, again, not at all an imager, but I can recognize some artifacts. And so if you recognize the artifacts, there's so much you can say about the ultrasound nephrocubic evaluation of the thoracic cavity. In human medicine, they will very often have done a CT scan, x-rays, and an ultrasound of the same patient. And so if there's someone who can convince us to do point of care ultrasound, it will be people writing papers on human medicine. And so if you look at the literature, actually point of care ultrasound is described to be more sensitive and more specific than x-rays to detect pleural or pericardial effusion, and a lot more sensitive to detect pneumothorax patients. So it is actually your preferred complementary examination if you don't have a CT available in human medicine. It is also more sensitive than x-rays to identify pulmonary contusions. So again, it is probably the one that will detect the lesions earlier than your x-rays. And it's also been described to be really helpful to detect cardiogenic or non-cardiogenic edema, to help in the diagnosis of pneumonia patients or detect thromboembolisms. So it is massively helpful, and it is worth your while to invest in learning these techniques. In general, with every dyspneic patient, and if you do emergency critical care, you don't want to have a diagnosis on a dead patient. You prefer to have a living patient and struggle to have a diagnosis. So keep your patients in the position that they breathe best. And as Amanda Borg and her colleagues once demonstrated doing blood gases, most dyspneic patients will just breathe best when they're in a sternal position or when they're in an upright position. So try to respect that position. And then think about your glass of water sitting next to you. You will see fluid will always be at the bottom and air will be at the top, as long as you're not flying around our planet Earth. So air up, fluid down, and you know where you have to look for your lesions. And so there's at least 7 protocols that have described different techniques to evaluate the entire thoracic cavity. I'm not a huge fan of the idea that you need to stick to a protocol in particular. I think at this time, our Scientific evidence is not sufficient to say which protocol is best as long as respect the logic that air will be on the top and fluid will be at the bottom. And just ask yourself, what am I looking for? Which can be based on a clinical examination. If you think there's muffled heart sounds ventrally, you'll probably want to look ventrally. I already mentioned a couple of times that you need to ask yourself, what are my questions that I want to answer to? When you're scanning the thoracic cavity, your first question should be, is this a normal image? Yes or no? Do I recognize that? Do I see B lines? Do I see a glide sign? Do I see a lung point? And do I see any pleural effusion? Those are probably the five basic first questions you should ask yourself. So if you talk about a normal image, you need to know how you would position your probe. And so the advice we would all give you is to put your probe perpendicular to the ribs. So you scan actually in between two ribs, with your two ribs being visual on the sides. So if you do this, you should get a normal image of a dry lung in a healthy patient, as is outlined here at the top right. You can see with the yellow green arrow your rib, and this is only the outer side of your rib. Everything above is chest wall, it's fat, it's muscle, it's skin. This is the second rib. And then in between, running actually underneath those ribs, because your pleura is at the inside, you see your pleural line becoming visible in the two. So this is your pleura. And then you can see reverberations at the bottom, which are those A lines, which are just hyperechoic lines, which are repeat ultrasound images of your initial pleural line. So this is a normal image. And this combination of a rib with a pleural line and another rib is called your Bat sign. I will demonstrate you in a second where it comes from. I don't know whoever invented it, and I think he might have had too much of Belgian beers, but if you look at the other underside of a bat, it should resemble your two ribs and the pleural line. If you want to evaluate this, typically in our small animals, you will have to use a depth of 4 to 6 centimeters when you're scanning this lung surface and you're evaluating the normal images. Now, in between those ribs, underneath the pleural line, you don't see anything because ultrasound beams don't like air. The A lines you see are artifacts. There's nothing to be seen. So at this point, in between a normal healthy lung or a pneumothorax, there is no distinction whatsoever. You would have exactly the same image, whether it be a healthy patient or a patient with a pneumothorax. So I will have to give you some extra solutions to tell you whether this patient has a pneumothorax, yes or no. And we'll come back to that shortly. For the time being, I first want to introduce another artifact, which is a B line. And it's been previously called ring down artifact or comet tails, but B lines, as we want you to identify them, have got several criteria. These are the vertical, severely hyperechoic lines that you might spot, again here illustrated by the green arrow. They will arise from the pleural line, so as you can see, it starts here at the bottom, and then it goes all the way down till the end of your screen. And if it would be a movie and you would see the lungs moving in your cine loop, you would see they actually move with respiration. And if there are A lines visible, they will actually just go straight through those A lines. You will no longer be able to see those A lines because they don't really care about their presence. And they can be indicative of something called wet lung or interstitial syndromes. And if you see one, it actually means that there must be contact of your lung with the thoracic wall. So it excludes a pneumothorax at that level. At that level. So again, if you see one or two B lines in one single view, that should still be considered normal. And so it is just a little alveoli that has got some fluid in it, which is surrounded by air, which creates this artifact. But one or two B lines in a single view is nothing to worry about. More than three B lines is exaggerated, it means there's too many alveoli that are filled with fluid, and is then described as an alveolar or interstitial alveolar syndrome, just as you would on a radiograph. If you see them, you know there's not a pneumothorax, and in a trauma patient, if it's dyspneic, you don't have a pneumothorax, and you see there's too much fluid in your alveoli, these are probably contusions. Again, you need to look at the history, the signalment, and the clinical findings to identify which type of fluid it is. Because in this paper by Ward, one of the criticisms they had for point-of-care ultrasound techniques is that This technique could not be used to differentiate cardiac pulmonary edema from other causes of diffuse interstitial or alveolar disease. I just want you to think for 2 seconds about that and appreciate that that is exactly the same as with a radiograph. It will be the distribution of your lesions, which you can identify in one single radiograph, but which you also know when you know where your probe was located. It will be about the signalment and the other clinical findings that will suggest what type of fluid you have in your alveoli. So I don't think it is the biggest criticism to be concerned about. If you start doing this and you start getting comfortable identifying B lines and you start to look at the pleura and at the lungs, you will start to see more lesions. And this is just a representation of a poster we had at IFEX this year. So you have an idea of the lesions you can see as the lesions and the amount of fluid accumulates. So at the top left, you see an image with pleura and a lot of B lines. This is a patient with a mild pneumonia due to aspiration. If you go to the right bottom, you can see that's actually a curtain, entire curtain of B lines. So there's more and more fluid accumulating until you will get these images. So here at the top right, you can actually see that underneath the pleura, suddenly you see some tissue. And that is a piece of lung that is completely fluid filled. There's no more air to be found in there. And so you can actually see the tissue. It's called consolidation of that part of the lung. And underneath, you see the hyperechoic line again. You see the B lines originating. And it seems like a very irregular surface. So it's like it's a shredded piece of paper. And that is the shred sign, where you have an irregular piece of consolidation and then air appears in your lung again. You cannot evaluate the lung anymore. You just see the irregular borders. An even more severe form is on the right bottom, where the entire lung, you see the pleural line here where the green arrow is, almost everything else underneath is looks like a liver, actually. That's because your entire lung lobe is completely fluid filled. So this is a very severe aspiration pneumonia case. And the only place you still have a little bit of lung is probably in this bronchus, where you have this irregular hyperechoic line, and then you see your shadows due to the air being in contact. So that is more advanced lesions that you will start to detect, and it's not really the scope of this point, but there's a lot of research ongoing on that at the moment. So again, a normal dry lung, you should have your bat sign, you should have your A lines, you have the shadows of your ribs, and this is a healthy patient. If now you want to know whether it's a healthy patient or a pneumothorax, the second thing you want to know is there a glide sign, yes or no? And so if you look at this schematic of what your thoracic wall might look like with your ribs, your A lines, and your pleural line, that pleural line actually is composed of two sheets which are severely intimately related with one another. It is your parietal and your visceral pleura, and there's just a scant amount of fluid making possible them for one to slide over the other. It's virtually impossible to discern those two in a live image. But you're looking for this back and through movement throughout respiration that you can see shimmering in this layer. If you see one pleural sheet sliding over the other and you see this back and forth movement, this glide sign, then you know there's not a pneumothorax in that level. Now, I already said a couple of times, you need to think about where fluid or air will accumulate. So if you have a pneumothorax, the most likely region where the air will accumulate should be here, caudal dorsally. That's where you think you should have your pneumothorax in mild cases. So you should learn how to go and look for it. And so if you look at the picture, the radiograph on the right, you see the white X. That's probably where you would want to look for the mild pneumothorax. If you then would like to rule out whether it's got pleural effusion, you probably want to slide down alongside the diaphragm and look for the ventral part. Now, unfortunately, it isn't that easy to just go from dorsal to ventral, as the thoracic cavity runs obliquely down towards cranioventral when you follow it. So it would be nice to be able to detect the transition in between the thoracic and the abdominal cavity. And then again, if you look at the ultrasound image on the left, this is the hyperechoic line. This is a rib. You still again see the pleural hyperechoic line. And then suddenly here, it stops. And if you take a closer look at the image, actually beyond that, To the right, you suddenly see images. You see content. You see this is abdominal content. Here are abdominal organs. This again is a rib shadow here at the bottom, at the top. So this is where the thoracic cavity ends and where the abdominal cavity starts. And if you would see this in a single loop, you would see that with breathing. If you breathe in, the hypericoid line will extend, breathe out, it will come back. And so it should be able to identify this curtain sign. And in this way, you can identify the most caudal part of the lungs and then slide your probe dorsally to identify the most likely spot for air to accumulate. You will see the first times you're trying to identify a glide sign. I would recommend you do this in your own pet, which is not stressed about the procedure and who is just calmly breathing. Because if a dog starts panting, there's very little movement of the lungs compared to the thoracic wall, and so it's almost impossible to see. If they get rapid shallow breathing, it becomes difficult to see. Now, if you have a dyspneic patient, he might be breathing rapidly and shallowly, so you should consider supplementing them with oxygen, which is always a good idea, and already giving them some pain relief and get them to calm down for a couple of minutes before you reassess these images. Moreover, just like with the abdomen, try to just keep your hand still at one single spot. Don't start shopping and moving around in all directions. You will avoid yourself to decently interpret those images. Don't move your hand. And if you have a sedated animal that's only breathing 6 times a minute, you need to wait for them to breathe to assess whether there's a glide sign. In stress, you might forget, so please remember that. And then again, a pneumothorax can be unilateral, so always check both sides of the thoracic cavity. That will help you once more. Despite all of those things, you might still be rather insecure whether you truly have a pneumothorax, yes or no. So there's more things that could help you. If you think about the movement of your lungs according to your thoracic wall, the biggest movement should be expected caudal dorsally. So if you don't see any movement there, but you think you see some more cranioventrally, you could actually, in this case, start moving your probe cranioventrally and hope you would find the point where your lungs get in touch with your thoracic wall again. Because in a mild pneumothorax, part of your lungs will still reach the parietal pleura. And so depicted on the left, you see an ultrasound image in which you follow the pleural line and then suddenly it stops. And here you still have a hyperechoic line, you still have A lines repeating. And so this is the lung point. This is the part where the contact is lost between the lungs and the thoracic wall. If you see that, then you know for sure that this part is a pneumothorax. And if you need to do a thoracentesis to take out the air, that's where you have to be. So looking for the lung point might definitely help you to be more certain that there truly is a pneumothorax. For those who need more of a 3D or 2D CT scan view, three different cross-sections of the thorax of dogs, the patient to the left has got perfectly healthy lungs, and you will see a glide sign where the probe is, even caudal dorsally. The patient to the outer right has got a severe unilateral pneumothorax. And no matter where your probe is, you will never see a glide sign. However, the patient depicted in the middle will have a glide sign at probe position number 3, will have a lung point visible at probe position number 2, and will have an absence of a glide sign at probe position number 1. So depending on the severity, you could actually even see to which extent there is loss of contact. Now, recently, Søren Jantine and I published a case series about an abnormal curtain sign. Again, I think this is going too far in a 1 hour talk to go into those details, but just think of it as the liver popping in the middle of your nice pleural line and saying hi to you, and you see air, abnormal content, and air. If you identify this in patients at the level of their caudal lung fields, until now we have the impression it's quite specific for a pneumothorax. In fact, we have not seen any other diagnosis than pneumothorax, but we need to evaluate more diaphragmatic hernias to see whether we could not find similar findings. So, just a case series. It's not evidence yet, but we'll work on it. So, in summary, every time you see a glide sign, you know the patient does not have a pneumothorax in that region. If you see B lines, the patient does not have a pneumothorax in that region. If you see a lung point, you know the patient has a pneumothorax to the caudal dorsal part of that lung point, And if you see an asynchronous curtain sign, it might be very indicative of a pneumothorax once more. I just want to re-emphasize the fact if you see B-lines, they rule out the pneumothorax. Because if you think about it, the most common scenario of a pneumothorax would be a traumatized patient. And if your traumatized patient comes in with severe dyspnea, you will either have contusions, which you will see as an exaggerated amount of B-lines, or you might have a pneumothorax, which suddenly looks completely normal. Or it could have pleural effusion or a diaphragmatic hernia. So I need to get back into the pleural effusion, which you will undoubtedly recognize as fluid accumulating in the thoracic cavity. Fluid you've recognized since you've been doing the abdominal point of care ultrasound scan, and you will never confound it with all of the artifacts we've just discussed. So it's a pretty straightforward diagnosis. I think probably the main mission is to detect patients with even small quantities of pleural effusion before they get dyspneic. And as said before, fluid should be at the bottom, so you need to scan the ventral part of your thorax when your patient is in the sternal position. And the best way to do it is to place your probe at the subxiphoid level, just like you did with the abdominal point of care ultrasound scan, because your fluid will tend to accumulate and sit just in front of the diaphragm. So if you want to do this in your patient who can no longer stand up, you could try an L-shaped table, like some people do. I have a foldable cardio table, and I will just put my patient over it and then have my probe going under the subxiphoid process to assess that region. So if you look at the subxiphoid view on your left side, just tilt your probe more horizontal and scan for the ventral part of the thoracic cavity, and you could find a little pocket of fluid. But don't forget to also go and point your probe outwards so you're sure to hit those spots as well. I think one jumped here. Besides that, you are always free to just check the entire ventral part. And if you're checking the ventral part, this is actually the part where you might want to turn your probe. When I first presented thoracic point of care ultrasound, if you start, hold your probe perpendicular to the ribs. But if you want to even detect small quantities, if in this patient on the left, I add a little bit of red fluid at the bottom, you know that you're going to have to be really, really performant to get this in your sights. So if you turn your probe 90 degrees and you're looking outwards, suddenly you will hit this much easier. And on top of that, you will actually be able to see the outside of your thoracic wall. You will see the fluid sitting next to the outside of your thoracic wall. So that is a little hint that will really help you to see something more. So for pleural effusion, I don't think you'll struggle in the very severely dyspneic patient to just see there's fluid, but there's ways to detect even smaller amounts. And so those would be to scan caudoventrally between your diaphragm and your heart, to turn your probe parallel to your ribs and there to scan towards the ventral parts, and by rocking and fanning your probe towards more horizontal into the lateral pockets when you're at the subxiphoid side. Again, not that necessary for your dyspneic patient due to pleural effusion, but we've had a couple of patients that we've diagnosed with a small pyothorax or with a carcinomatosis when we could just sample this little pocket of fluid because we learned how to look for them better. So it will help your emergency patients. And Yantina, a couple of years ago, did a very nice study about 100 emergency patients that they took in at the university. And they checked to which extent these patients were likely to have any sign of free abdominal, pleural, or pericardial fluid. The striking finding was that if they had cardiovascularly unstable or dyspneic patients, 27 out of 36 of those patients had some free fluid in one of these three areas. Inversely, the 36 stable patients that 64 stable patients that entered, only 6 of them, so only 9%, had some free fluid. So this clearly demonstrates how in every unstable, whether it's cardiovascular or respiratory patient that walks through your door, point of care ultrasound will probably help you to guide his therapy. And please just note that in this protocol, they didn't evaluate whether there was any sign of wet lungs or of alveolar interstitial syndrome, of an increased amount of B-lines. So the amount of patients that come in with respiratory distress or that are cardiovascularly unstable, in which these couple of techniques to the point of care ultrasound will turn out to be helpful, I would probably guess it will be around 90% of your patients. so if you want more motivation, it will be hard for me to find it. For those who have read some of the things I'm working on mostly, you will know it's a lot about the vascular and the cardiac system and how we can use this with point-of-care ultrasound. So allow me to just spend a couple of minutes to explain how this might be of any help. In human medicine, they will very often look at your inferior vena cava with ultrasound in an emergency setting, and they will use this to assess your volume status. We've been looking at whether we could do the same in dogs, and so there are three different sites that are usually being described. It's either at the level of the kidney and supraileic level, so you put your probe very far dorsally, as you can see here, and you will go and look at your caudal vena cava and your aorta. And you can do this longitudinally, or you could turn your probe and then have a cross section. You could actually look through the right intercostal space where my arrow is sitting right now, and through the liver, you're going to identify the portal vein, the caudal vena cava, and the aorta. That is a technique that is being performed by a couple of our Italian colleagues. And then the last one is you use the subxiphoid view, which you're already using more and more often, and now you just zoom out even further so you get more depth, up to 10 to 14 centimeters of depth. And completely at the bottom, you can see your caudal vena cava, where it actually runs through your diaphragm. This is your diaphragm, and this is where you'll see your caudal vena cava. And so all three have been described. All three undoubtedly have their advantages and their disadvantages, and I will let you pick your poison towards the future, and I will tell you what is my preferred one. But just to give you an idea that, again, this is not things we invented ourselves. A lot of smart people were already doing it in human medicine. The first description of looking at your caudal vena cava in dogs probably should be given to Nelson et al., in which they intentionally induced a severely hypervolemic state in experimental dogs and looked at what happened with the caudal vena cava, whether it was related with central venous pressure, and whether it could even be correlated with gallbladder thickness. And guess what? There was a clear correlation. So if they induced severe hypervolemia, they would see the caudal vena cava increasing in size, and they would see the development of gallbladder wall edema, just as we might have expected based on what we said before. Inversely, there are three different publications at least, one from the Canadian Vet Journal, and then there's the group from the RBC, and then there's Maxime Cambournac from Lyon and now Paris, who looked at the caudal vena cava after blood donation compared to prior to blood donation. And they could identify that your caudal vena cava significantly decreased after blood donation. Now, I always show these numbers just to get a feel for what the degree of change would be. And so their diameter in the caudal vena cava decreased from 1.28 to 1.01 centimeters. And although this might seem very disappointing at first because it's a 2 millimeter change, just bear in mind that these are healthy blood donors. We've induced moderate hypovolemia. We don't do blood donations and end up with our patients being in shock. So these patients are moderately volume depleted at the end of the procedure, not in hypovolemic shock. So the change with the clinical patient would be much more striking. Now, the ways these methods have been described is just by purely evaluating a fixed size of the caudal vena cava, while in human medicine, they will more rely on its collapsibility index because the caudal vena cava is a very thin-walled structure and will very easily change in size according to the difference in pressure or filling that you will find there. And if you take the same human being that is breathing in and out, if they breathe in, they will create a negative pressure in the thoracic cavity and they will actually suck the blood out of the inferior vena cava towards the heart. So the line in blue represents the size of your inferior vena cava. During expiration and during inspiration, they suddenly decrease in size, and when they expire, it gets bigger again. And you can look at the change in size throughout those respiratory cycles to get an idea whether there's any sign of hypervolemia. Now, rather than the line in blue, if you would be mechanically ventilated, this relationship will be inverted. If you are under mechanical ventilation, when you receive a breath, we're actually pushing more pressure into the thoracic cavity, and so you'll get impeded blood flow towards the heart. So if you're hypovolemic, like the bottom red line is depicting, suddenly you'll see a more severe change in inferior vena cava size while you're being ventilated. And I'm not going to go through all the papers in human medicine, but I think it's most important to just know that there's already meta-analysis being performed about it. So it's not one or two papers, like very often is the case in veterinary medicine. It's a bunch of papers who all found encouraging findings, saying that changes less than 20% in between inspiration and expiration are probably indicative of hypervolemia, while changes greater than 60% in between the minimal and the maximal size in inspiration and expiration are associated with hypovolemia. What I really like about it respects a big gray zone. There is a big region where you cannot make a definitive call, but that is very often the case in emergency situations. So, just so you know, more than 60% change, you're most certainly confronted with hypovolemia, and you should act upon it. If we look at our dog here in lateral recumbency with our probe at the subxiphoid level, and we're going to aim more dorsally, so you'll probably have to orient your probe more towards the spine compared to this image here, you have the three typical scenarios that you could appreciate as well. So at the two Topham illustrations, if the ones on the left are the ones in expiration, the ones on the right are the ones in inspiration, our first patient has got a modest decrease in size from expiration to inspiration, especially when you compare it to the second patient, who's got a smaller caudal vena cava to begin with, and when there's an inspiration being performed, it almost collapses. This patient is bound to be hypovolemic. If, however, it is large to begin with, and during inspiration there's another big change in size, you should consider he's either hypervolemic, hyper, so too much volume, or he could have right-sided congestive heart disease. And so you could actually imagine that this patient could have some gallbladder wall edema on the same illustration. But again, some things you might see, some things you might not yet see. It is all a matter of how severe and how acute those derangements are. When I discuss this with people out there, they sometimes have severe skepticism whether this would work. So, since this year, I present them this slide from one of our residents. It will take me a little bit of time to go through it, but I think it's so nice because it is a scenario in which you probably would have never thought you would see severe caudal vena cava sizes. So actually, what you're looking at here are different patients with mitral valve disease. These are all dogs, 81 dogs with mitral valve disease, and we've been looking at their caudal vena cava, and we've depicted their caudal vena cava according to the ACVM stages of mitral valve disease. So the patients to the left being noted as B1, which are here, those are the patients in stage B1. If you then go to the outer right, those seven patients are already in advanced mitral valve disease and they are stage D. I think we all know from the people here that one of the mainstays of their treatment will be diuretics, because in cardiac disease, you'll get stimulation of the RAS system, and those patients tend to keep volume, and so they get hypervolemic as their cardiac disease progresses. And the colors you're looking at are actually the subjective assessments of our resident when she looked at the caudal vena cava, whether she would think they were flat, so more towards hypovolemia, normal in size, or rather fat, so they were big and they did not collapse. You don't need to have a lot of scientific training to see that the fat caudal vena cavas are much more present towards more advanced cardiac disease, while normal or even towards flat caudal vena cavas are much more common in less advanced disease. So you can even see that you get more and more hypervolemia as disease progresses. And the resident who was supposed to do those evaluations was blinded to their stage. She only got to see the caudal vena cava sinolobes and had to look at them. And if you still think they might have been biased and might have been by pure chance, we actually have the same graphs in which we measured the caudal vena cava at the subxiphoid level, and it gave exactly the same values. So there's no requirement to definitely measure your caudal vena cava and the collapsibility index at the subxiphoid view. You should be able to eyeball it. In human medicine, in an emergency situation, again, they will look at the caudal vena cava or in the inferior vena cava collapsibility in human medicine, and they will eyeball whether they think it is hypovolemic and thus flat, whether hypovolemic and thus fat, or it's more towards normal. And so, if this works in cardiac states, that brings me to what you should also dare to do, and that is to try to use your ultrasound machine and learn how to do an abbreviated echocardiography. It is part of what is being taught in emergency critical care curriculums for medics, and I'm more and more convinced that we should try to enter that in the protocols for all of our residents in ECC in veterinary medicine as well. One of the things you should definitely be learning to do is to look at a short axis cross-sectional view of your left and right ventricle and learn to dare to assess contractility and filling. And again, that filling might be interesting because it could again inform you about the volume status of your patients. Now, the left atrium to aortic size is going to be an even better marker, but could be more influenced by any type of mitral valve disease or other cardiac pathology that would create some congestive heart disease. You can also already look at your cross-sectional or mushroom views of your left ventricle, and you can go from a rather hypovolemic patient in the middle, which in systole could even have these papillary muscles kissing each other, to a much more hypervolemic patient in which you actually see that this mushroom is being stretched out in diastole. So it will give you another idea of cardiac function in general. You'll be able to detect your dilated cardiomyopathy rather easily. You will see that's not too hard, and you can assess volume status. And I know many people think I might be pushing it too far at this moment. And so Joanna Aitken made a survey from the University of Surrey together with VetsNow to see how many of the emergency clinicians at VetsNow felt comfortable doing these abbreviated cardiac procedures. And if you recognize yourself in these numbers, then just understand that this is normal, but I'm just hoping that in 10 years the numbers will change. Because at that moment, most respondents would say, yes, I can identify pericardial effusion. And almost 90% would still be able to detect cardiac tamponade, so a concave aspect of your atrium. If you would, however, talk about assessing contractility, 20% would already start to feel uncomfortable. And one of the best ways to assess volume status together with the caudal vena cava being a left atrium to aortic ratio. So here on this top image, you see a Mercedes ring, which is your aorta with the leaflets. And this whale is your left atrium. If you calculate this size compared to that size, you should be able to get your left atrium to aortic ratio. Only 40% of respondents felt comfortable doing so. Even if we would talk about could you assess CVCs, only 10% felt comfortable. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. But before you get completely uncomfortable, and we've published a paper in which you just evaluated the time course it took us to have repeatable basic measurements in echocardio. And after 6 hours of training, you should be able to do basic echocardiogram measurements and caudal vena cava diameters in a healthy population of beagles. I completely accept that a healthy population of beagles is not the same as an emergency stressful environment of perhaps an aggressive English bulldog. Things will change, and 6 hours is probably an optimistic evaluation of how much time it could take. But please be aware that if you start to train these things, just like your point of care ultrasound of the abdomen, just like point of care ultrasound of the thoracic cavity, you need to start by doing this on healthy patients. And then you'll start to feel comfortable doing it in emergency situations. And so, if you have any more interest in this topic, or if you're an emergency fanatic, don't remember that on the 3rd we'll have a European symposium, and that will precede the EVEC Congress that will be held from the 4th to the 6th of June in Ghent, in Belgium. And if you have any further questions, you can happily ask them to me right now. Thank you very much.
There are no questions at the moment, Chris, but that was brilliant. And if there are any and anyone wants to send them through to me, then obviously I can pass them on. But on behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Chris for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.